Thank you. Can you hear me? Yeah, the speaker's on? Yeah. Good. Okay. So thanks for having me here. I'm really enjoying the meeting. Richard may have some competition for the outlier talk because I'm not going to talk about adaptation. But the format of the talk actually came out of a recent meeting at Banff where Chris Kosner and I spent some time talking about movement models and adaptation and ideal free distributions. And so I'd like to talk about how we might model movement in complex environments and then leave it to Chris to talk about the adaptation. And he's right after the break, so we requested that our talks were one after the other. Oh, yeah, so I have a bold underlined name here, and this is my graduate student, Hannah McKenzie, who is at the University of Alberta. And this is part of her master's work. She's now completed that. She's working on her PhD. And it's also in collaboration with Evelyn Merrill, who's just down the hall, who's animal movement modeler and empiricist. And also, unlike some of the talks today, I didn't start thinking about this problem in terms of theory. I actually blame Evelyn for getting me involved in a very practical problem where eventually the theory came out and bit me, and it seemed obvious that there was something there. So the approach I'm going to take is to actually focus on the practical problem first. And one reason I really enjoyed working on this problem and have enjoyed collaborating with people like Evelyn is that there are these amazing amounts of data that one can get from things like remote sensing where we can understand how animals are moving. And then as a mathematical modeler, I'm interested in how to put these into a broader framework. And I know others here are also. And so I'm going to talk about the biological problem, which is really based on the development of oil and gas in Alberta, where there are many lines, like cut lines that go through, that are used for exploration. And these can provide corridors for animals to move on. And of course, one thing that's quite interesting is when you have wolf populations, I'll take this off, we might be interested in how these cut lines are affecting their impact on prey species. And when we first started thinking about this, we started thinking about simulating. Are you getting a little feedback?
Yeah.
I wonder if...
when you walk forward.
Ah, okay. I'll stay here. Okay. That works. It's okay now? Yeah. Okay. We started thinking about simulating animal movement, and then we decided that wasn't the way we wanted to go. And we wanted to use something called first passage time. And then it turns out that this can be written in terms of some quite interesting and elegant mathematical theory that goes back to things like diffusion approximations. And when we started doing this, then we found that we could apply first passage time theory to predator-prey interactions and into functional responses in general. And some of the results we got were very counterintuitive. And I want to present some of those results today, partly in an effort to generate discussion, so you can tell me if you think what I'm telling you makes sense, or if it doesn't, how I should improve it, and because I'm going to claim that often we write down our functional responses the wrong way, okay? So that's the take-home message. And then I'm going to go back to the actual problem itself, which is to do with wolves foraging in anisotropic environments, and then try to tie together with some theory. Okay, so these are, this is a snowy Alberta foothills picture where you see there's lots of areas where there's been oil and gas cut lines or small roads put in, and these provide very useful corridors for animal movement. And there's quite a bit of theory that suggests that these corridors have a potential to affect the distribution and abundance of animals. There's a few quotes up here. There's certainly a concern that as development increases, then perhaps certain species like woodland caribou will become more susceptible to predation. And So here's just another picture of some seismic lines, and they're very frequent in Alberta. Typically, you don't have to go more than a half a kilometer to find one, even in fairly remote areas. And there's some association with higher risk of predation. There's some evidence that wolves use these as travel corridors, and that movement is directed relative to linear features. And so you might think about these maybe as we would use the freeway if we go to the supermarket. Do we get onto the freeway and drive to an area where we're able to forage effectively and then go back home? Instead of hopping over neighborhood fences. Okay, so this is the study area. It's in the Yahatinda location in the foothills of so Calgary's around here and Edmonton's around here. And that's a picture in the late winter. And I'm really going to focus on wolf movement, but their species are primarily elk and also moose. And this is data that Jackie Fryer, another student of Evelyn's, kind of dug up to show the linear features, roads, pipelines, and seismic lines in this area. So you can see it is highly developed, and of course there's some concern about the impact that may have. Okay. So Evelyn really and her crew put these collars on the wolves, and I know there's some others in the room that have been involved with this work as well. For some of the time, they record their locations every 5 minutes. Okay, so very short temporal frequency of movement locations. And we could also get the linear features and see if they were how they were moving with respect to the linear features. Were they moving along them, or were they moving across them? Were they attracted towards them? Okay. And the linear features we measure in kilometers per kilometer squared, and this is the density here. So they're in various different densities of linear features. Okay, so this is the kind of movement path that you'd see, fixed every 5 minutes. And here are the relocations. And it's loaded onto a GPS collar, and then the collar is released, and then it's downloaded onto the computer, and then you have these patterns. You can, then I get the data, or Hannah gets the data, and then that's the kind of thing we're looking at. Okay, so that's the setup, okay? And so now I want to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about a definition of first passage time. So the idea of first passage time is it should be, typically we talk about the mean or the average first passage time. It would be the length of time it would take to find a resource or bump into a location, given that you start at a particular location. So if you were to do this many times, you would get a whole variety of different lengths of time it would take you to find that resource. But then if you average these arithmetically, that would be the mean first passage time. And so a very simple example goes back to Berg, who is actually a physicist who worked in cell biology. He put a cell in a petri dish, and he let it wander around via diffusion and see how long it took before it hit a disk that was sticky and stuck to the disk. And if you repeated that experiment many times, you get the mean first passage time by averaging all those numbers. Well, you could say the same thing for a predator-prey interaction. You might say, on average, how long does it take you to find a prey item? And if you can work that out more in a more complicated way, could you ask how does the environmental variability affect that length of time? Okay, so that's just what we talked about. Average time taken to reach a site or set of sites for the first time. There could be many of these sticky disks in the petri dish. And there are other alternatives like mean squared displacement that people have used as statistics. And we can think about this in terms of strategy for searching efficiency. And we think of the mean first passage time as inversely related to the encounter rate. So if you're encountering prey at a certain rate, mean first passage time would be proportional to 1 over that rate. And then we can think about how we would then put that in a functional response. We'd say I have a hauling functional response. The encounter rate is one of the key elements. Okay, so the easiest place to start is on a one-dimensional space. And we can just kind of get a flavor of how to think about it here. And the simplest model, which is not really applicable to wolves, is you're doing this hop on a line. You're either moving to left or to the right at every time step. And you have a 50% chance of moving in either direction. And you jump distance delta. Okay? So this is sort of how you might think of also modeling a very simple diffusion process. And the idea is, just like when you derive a diffusion approximation, you have a master equation here for W, which is the mean first passage time. And it just looks back one time step. And so it says, if you're at point X, okay, the mean first passage time, and you haven't yet hit the boundary, the mean first passage time to hitting the boundary is the length of time for one jump, plus the probability you came from the left, times the W of X minus delta, plus the probability you came from the right, times W of X plus delta. So this is a recursive relationship that walks you back one time step. And so you might say, well, that's kind of a tautology. That may not really be that interesting. But it turns out it's very useful, if not interesting. Okay? And so the idea is, what you would do if you're doing a diffusion approximation is you would sort of expand everything out in sight with Taylor series and then take some diffusion limit. And that's what you do here. You expand this W out in a Taylor series in the small parameter delta. And then you think about the case where tau gets small and delta gets small, and tau over 2 delta squared is your diffusion coefficient. So it's very much analogous to how you would derive a diffusion equation. And you get this differential equation right here. The second derivative of W with respect to space plus a constant is equal to 0. If you were to add a bias in, okay, and maybe let the movement, the probability of jumping to the right or left depend on space, you get something that looks like this. D of X times the second derivative of W with respect to X plus the advection coefficient times the first derivative plus 1 is equal to 0. So this has some similarities with the Fokker-Planck equation or the advection diffusion equation that we might have seen somewhere else. And it can actually be connected to it. Okay, and so basically the Ford-Kolmogorov equation or the Fokker-Planck equation is given at the top here, and it's got time in it, and it says the rate of change of density of individuals is equal to an advection term plus a diffusion term. Okay, and this would describe looking forward in time. It turns out the backward Kolmogorov equation says, given that you're at a location at a current time, where could you have come from in a previous time? And then this mean first passage time equation can actually be derived from the backwards Kolmogorov equation. Okay, so this is what we're going to look at. It's related to this more familiar advection diffusion equation, but it's quite different. It doesn't involve a time derivative, and the way that the D and the C come into it are a little different. Okay, so if we have that in hand, what can we do? Well, let's just go back and look at the simple form of the equation, which I think is right here. Okay, so the second derivative of this function W is equal to a constant. Okay, so you differentiate it twice, it's equal to a constant. So what kind of function might that be? Parabola, right? Yeah. So, yeah, okay. Just want to make sure everyone's on the same page. Okay. So in this case, it's actually not too complicated. So we can think about the boundary conditions here. This is where the sticky point is. There's a reflection here. Okay, and we know that the solution to this equation will be a parabola. Okay, here it is. Okay, that satisfies the boundary conditions. It just looks like this. So it says if you start right on the boundary, okay, where there's a sticky point, it's going to take you zero length of time to get there. If you start further away towards the right, then it'll take you longer. And so this is the solution to that equation for the mean first passage time. And I think we set the diffusion coefficient. Yeah, it's in there, D. So, okay, that corresponds to our intuition. Things that start further away from the boundary take longer to get there. Okay, how might we use this for functional responses? One thing we can do is say, let's stay in one dimension for now. We haven't quite got back to the wolves yet. But we're just going to go along and we're going to drop down non-moving prey items like a Poisson process in space. So there's the point zero. We move forward and we drop them x1, x2, x3. Okay. We go in the other direction, we do the same thing. And so if you have a Poisson process in space, it means that there's no correlations between individuals. You have a constant probability per unit space of dropping an individual. And the distance between individuals would have an exponential distribution. Okay? So now we can think about the case, if we were to release a predator right here, and it's just doing a random walk, how long would it take it to hit this one or this one? Okay, so here hitting any prey item would be sufficient to first passage time. Well, you just connect these with parabolas with the appropriate slope. Okay? Because you're solving that simple equation. And here they are. Right? Okay, so this would describe the first passage times for all the different starting locations. So you might say, well, I just want to know what the average is, so you could average this over space if you wanted to. Okay? And you could do the same for advection. Here, you're just marching in a straight line at a constant speed. So the length of time it takes you, if you start just to the right of this point, it'll just take you a long time to get to here. If you start just the left of this point, it'll take you a very short time. And it'll just be the sawtooth function here. So you can do the same for the more complicated case where you have advection and diffusion. But I won't go through it there. It's just you get these lopsided parabolas. So, given this, we can then try to work out the mean first passage time. And this is the length of time you might think it would take to, for a predator to find a prey under simple diffusive motion or under simple advective motion. And I guess I have to say something here, which I meant to say earlier. And that is that the motivation for this is a case where the prey are fairly widely spaced. So, like wolves foraging for elk, the elk may be miles apart. And so the scale for finding the prey is the same as the movement scale. It would be very different if your prey were found on a very local scale and your movement was on a much larger scale. Okay. So if we want to work out the expected encounter rate, well, we really do it by using this distribution of distances, the exponential distribution that comes from the Poisson process, and this W function, which will either be a linear or quadratic function, and then we average it over the different length of interval here. And we think about this as the encounter rate, and here lambda, the intensity of the Poisson process, is like the prey density, okay? The number of individuals per unit length we expect to find. And this, of course, only works when we have a randomly distributed prey distribution via a Poisson process. So what we get if we have pure advection is very much like a type 1 functional response. The rate at which we find prey is proportional to the advection coefficient C, and there's a constant of proportionality in there. And we could replace N by lambda, okay? That's just the density. But rather interestingly, when we have diffusion, we get something different. We get a prey density squared. And so this says if we move by simple diffusive motion and we double the prey density, we're going to find prey 4 times faster. So this is a little bit different than the Hawling disk equation. So the Hawling disk equation says when you sort of drive the kind of classical functional responses, you think you're sweeping out a path at a constant speed, and how many prey do you see per unit time? So this is more akin to pure advection. But indeed, if we do have random motion and we're kind of going back and forth and not sweeping out a disk, we're going to actually have a different shape to the functional response here, which actually has more of a shape of a type 3 functional response with that inflection. So if we put in the simple diffusion here and we use the standard, I thought Roger was going to be here, so I put up Gurney and Nisbet, but he's not here. So. But or anyone else's textbook, right? Simple diffusion, you'd get your handling time in there. This would be like your your encounter rate would be proportional to the diffusion coefficient times the density squared here. So you get something that looks like that. So the first thing is, with this rather oversimplified model, what we're getting is a functional response which has something like a type 2 flavor, but also has a type 3 flavor, but doesn't need to invoke any of those arguments that we usually do for type 3, which are rather complicated and include things like switching. Okay. So moving on to the next part, I'd like to try to apply this theory to the problem with wolves, but that's a harder problem, so I'd like to apply it to an easier problem, which is for red foxes. And this is there's this beautiful paper by Sinus and Jessen, and they worked in Cedar Creek in Minnesota back in the 60s, and they had a radio telemetry tower, and they got the location of the fox every 10 minutes in this field or large open area, and they had published the distribution of step lengths and turning angles. And I actually contacted Sinus maybe 5 years ago for the data, and of course he didn't have it. He had this big computer printout, those wide sheets that zigzag back and forth. So he put those in the mail to me, and I fortunately had a summer student that entered it all. And so that's what it looks like. That's every 10 minutes. It's a beautiful data set. And there's very little environmental variability as far as I could tell from my interactions with Sinus. And when you look at the turning angles, they're shown here. They've got this sort of interesting distribution. There's a den site in the middle, and they're biased towards the den site. Okay, so we fitted this, turns out to be a von Mises distribution, which is like a circular normal distribution. So you can get the distribution of step lengths and distribution of turning angles. Okay, and so if you want to, you can then go from a one-dimensional model to a radially symmetric two-dimensional model with random movement and bias towards the den site. Okay, so when we do that, we're going to say, given that this is how the animal moves, how long on average will it take it to find a prey item at different distances from the den site? So this isn't as complicated as the wolf problem, but it's in two dimensions and it's radially symmetric. Okay, so this turns out to be the formula. Again, it's rather interesting. The advection vector comes outside. It's a dot product with the gradient here. There's a simple diffusion coefficient. That's the two-dimensional diffusion operator, the Laplacian. And these little vectors are pointing towards the den site. They indicate the direction of C. So you can think about it. This is the random component of motion. This is the directed component. C is a vector with a constant magnitude, but a direction that points towards the den site. And then this is the mean first passage time equation. So we could put down a prey at different locations here and have a detection radius and say, how long does it take to find that prey? And then we're moving one step closer to that original problem. We worked out the C and the D from the original data. You can sort of just put prey at the den or a little further away and so on and so forth. And then we assumed there was a reflecting boundary so the fox wouldn't leave its general vicinity. But now we have to solve this thing numerically, so we just use some computer code for that called COMSOL. And so what we end off with is a surface, okay? And here, just to make life exciting, those prey items that went out to the right are now going down to the bottom. Okay, so just in case you're wondering. Okay, so there's a prey item right at the den site. There's one a kilometer away and one and a half kilometers away. Okay, and then this column here is simple diffusion, and this column here is the diffusion plus advection. So this is with the data as taken for the red fox. And the colors indicate the length of time to find the prey item. Okay. So as you move further away from the center, here, say, when we have the centralizing tendency, it's taking longer and longer to find the prey item. when you start here, if you take a point on this surface, it's green, so say it's about 125, so it would take, I guess, 150, so it would take a rather long time to find that prey item undergoing that random walk. It would take less if you start close to the item there. So hopefully that makes sense. Another way to look at it is if we think about the prey distance from the den site and we're doing a random walk and one with a centralizing tendency. The one with a centralizing tendency is more able to find prey items close to the den site than the random walk, and the random walk does better at finding things further away than the one with a centralizing tendency. So we were kind of excited about this as modelers because we felt like this is a sort of a different paradigm for looking at predation, and we hadn't really seen it used. Mean first passage time or first passage time does come up in the ecological literature in a variety of places, but it hasn't been so widely used with these differential equations. And the beauty of this is if you were going to work this out via simulation, you'd have to go to every point in your domain, okay, and you'd have to do a whole bunch of simulations and get the whole distribution of first passage times and then take the mean and then move on to the next point and do it again and again. So we're trading that off with a model that is this one here, which computes the entire surface at one time. Okay, it's a partial differential equation, so it's not as straightforward to solve, but it's much faster to solve. And what we're doing when we use the partial differential equation is we're just using the first two moments of the movement behavior, the first two infinitesimal moments, and we're assuming that's good enough to describe what's going on. Okay, so to apply it back to the foraging example, again, this is the picture we saw before with the linear features and so forth. Okay, this is the equation now, okay, with anisotropy. So now your diffusion can be anisotropic. So if you're moving on a linear feature, you're more likely to move up or down it than you are along it. You may be attracted to it by the advection. If you're close to it, you may move towards it. Okay, so this is a movement in the x direction, movement in the y direction, and these are the cross directions. These two terms can be coupled together because they're just mixed derivatives, and then the attraction or the advection term. And so, of course, when animals move, there's all kinds of complicated things going on behaviorally, and so we're saying, well, we're not really trying to model that. We're just trying to do some kind of statistical averaging of what they do on average, I guess, and put those into these summary statistics, the C's and the D's, okay? And so there's a lot of behavior we're not putting in there. And then we put the boundary conditions on. So again, we have a distribution of turning of distances and turning angles, and we can look at the turning angle relative to the normal vector for the linear feature. And so when we do that, we get things like this. So it turns out the way we defined it in terms of the normal to the linear feature, when you have pi over 2 or minus pi over 2, you're moving along that linear feature, okay? So there's definitely, when you're on the linear feature, you tend to be moving along it, and when you're close, you tend to be moving parallel to it. Okay, so when we put that into our model, then we can look at calculating the advection coefficient and the diffusion coefficient in terms of these turning redistribution angles functions, which are the product of this and this, work out the coefficients, and then just run simulations for different kinds of linear features. Okay, so this is a low density, our current density, and a high density, and see what happens. So then we put this on the computer, and then we can try it for different kinds of features like random distribution or clump distributions, say the prey are near linear features or they're far. And then for each of these, we'll generate a surface, and then we can average the surface to see what's going on. And so here's a sample calculation, okay? So we can do this in a couple of minutes on the computer, and here's the landscape, these are the linear features, this is a 25 by 25 kilometer grid, this is the mean first passage time, the length of time it takes to find a prey item, based on the real radio tracking data But now, with those coefficients used to parameterize for this particular road configuration. And there's another one where they're clumped. This, again, this, the height of the the color of the surface indicates the length of time it takes to find a prey item. And then we can compare what happens when the road density increases or decreases. Okay, so I just want to focus on this right here. I think this is the main picture, the main message. This is the density of linear features here, okay? If there's random movement, the density of linear features doesn't make a difference. But if there's anisotropic diffusion, so movement, if you're more likely to move along the linear features once you're on them, this will effectively increase your overall movement rate. And so the mean first passage time, the length of time it takes to find a prey item, could be reduced to about 60% of what would be without. So another way we can think about this is if we look at the ratio of functional responses as a function of prey density, when prey densities are low, the linear features can increase the rate of the effectiveness of the encounter rate, or the rate of the encounter, by about 40%. And this is decreased when the prey density is higher. Okay, so for me this was really intellectually interesting, and as so often happens, we thought we kind of invented all this theory because we weren't reading the right papers. And then gradually as we started to read the right papers, we realized we were reinventing the theory and that it has been very widely used in things like population dynamics for stochastic population fluctuations and so forth, but it hasn't really been applied in an ecological context in the way we're doing it here, and in particular in with respect to functional responses and so forth. So one of the take-home messages is that we can use these tools of advection and diffusion in this new context of mean first passage time. And I think functionally this is really interesting. And another thing that comes out of it that really has me puzzled but interested and excited is that if you just move by simple diffusion, you're going to get the sigmoidal functional response. And we couldn't see that in the literature. Maybe if someone knows where has seen that elsewhere, tell me and I'd be interested. And of course, there's this applied side to the work, which is actually looking at the effective linear features on functional responses. And so what we found was when we went from none to sort of the highest level, which we looked at, which is double what is there now, we found something like a 40% increase in encounter rate. So it's a noticeable but not extreme. Okay. And then we also came up with the conclusion that the prey at low densities are most susceptible to the increased functional response. Okay, so theoretical perspectives. So we started down here with actual just data sets for individual movements and locations of roads. Started thinking about how wolves might respond to linear features moving along them versus in other directions. And then we can do this mean first passage time theory and diffusion approximation to get a search time to ask how long does it take to find a prey item. And then from there, we can actually go to a functional response formulation, and we can start thinking about how are predator-prey dynamics affected. If we go back to what we were talking about earlier, if before I did the work, if I were going to write down a simple advection diffusion equation with a type 1 functional response, I would have written this down for the predator, okay? Rate of change of predator density, okay, plus the drift or the advection term is equal to the diffusion, plus, and this is type 1, okay, n is the prey density, and it assumes that sort of the hauling disk type equation, we're not worrying about handling time at this point. From what I can see from the work, if we were just looking at this with advection, then the form of the equation would be the same, but now we would write A in terms of the advection speed. So if we're thinking about changing the parameter, the advection speed and equation, we should also be thinking about changing the encounter rate here, okay? Which sort of makes intuitive sense. On the other hand, if we're thinking about it through random motion, we get rid of this term, okay? And then this A would be in terms of the diffusion coefficient and another parameter here, but now there'd be an N squared, which is a little bit different. And, okay, so now if you have advection and diffusion, we don't have a nice formula. You can try to integrate, but it's not, it ain't pretty. Okay, and that's Hannah there, and she did most of the work I talked about. Thank you.